It is your Thoroughly Jewish host on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Let's do it.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
That is the sound of the shofar blast at the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall, the Kotel, the Wall, as Jews know it, celebrating Yom HaAtzma'ut, Israeli independence. Yes, the birth of the nation of Israel just days after Holocaust Remembrance Day, which kind of says it all. This is Michael Brown. Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on the Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH, number to call, 866-348-7884. A whole lot to talk about, as always, and your Jewish-related calls. Any Jewish-related question you have, question regarding Israel and the Jewish people, Jewish customs, Jewish traditions, anything you want to find out about the Hebrew language, things like that. Glad to take your Jewish-related questions today, 866-348-7884. Okay, this is unrelated to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. I almost never do this in terms of other news that we break in with on a Thursday. But in case you haven't heard this, now this is just being reported, Joey, clip number 14. This is just being reported. I can't verify anything, but this was on CBS News. Listen to this.
Reality TV star Caitlyn Jenner is reportedly considering transitioning back to a man. Jenner announced her transition from man to woman last year, but has allegedly been experiencing sex change regret. That's according to the author of a new book about the Kardashian family. The author says while Jenner was, quote, thrilled to champion transgender issues, she may detransition to a male in the next couple of years. Jenner has been credited with helping bring transgender issues into the mainstream. Her reality show, I Am Kate, gave viewers an inside look at her transition process and its challenges. According to the website The Wrap, the transition has been very hard for Jenner. Multiple sources close to the Kardashian family are reportedly saying Jenner may be considering a reversal because she is still interested in women.
All right, let's really pray for God to get hold of Bruce Jenner and make him whole from the inside out. But, and then we're not going to, please don't call about this, all right? I know you may want to weigh in. You can read my article, Five Reasons Why Transgender is Not the New Black. But just to say this plainly, the guy is still a heterosexual male who likes women, who is attracted to women. And he's attracted to women as a man. Otherwise, he'd be identifying as a lesbian, according to this report. Okay? According to this report. So, allegedly. But the media, which has been quick to say that he is she is thinking of transitioning, then she will go back to he. And that'll be fine. Which indicates this is not reality we're dealing with. This is not, okay, here, this is the my studio desk that I'm hitting right now. Okay, this is the mic that I'm tapping now. No, it's not that. It's that the mic perceives itself to be a kitten and the desk perceives itself to be an automobile, and we're going along with this. So my hope is that Bruce Jenner will lead the way back to sanity, intentionally or not. Okay, that's it. That's all we're going to say about it. But in case you hadn't heard that, again, this is all alleged, but it makes perfect sense to me because plenty of people experience sex change regret. If you want to find out more, if you're one of those struggling with questions, go to sexchangeregret.com. Sexchangeregret.com. Okay, with that, back to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown. Delighted to be with you. 866-348-7884. That is the number to call with any Jewish-related question. Okay, here's something really interesting. It has to do with Israel and the Jewish people in a very, very direct way. And, before I say that, my open letter to Megyn Kelly referenced Montel Williams a couple of places. Montel Williams took strong exception to my open letter to Megyn Kelly, actually thinking that certain things I took issue with her over, I was blaming him for, which wasn't the case, as just a careful reading would indicate. But in any case, he wrote a response to me. So Montel Williams wrote a response to my open letter to Megyn Kelly and immediately agreed to come on this radio show to discuss the issues. It won't be until next month. God willing, will be next month, though, but he's got a number of things on his plate, traveling and family issues and things like that, et cetera. So just stuff he's got to take care of, and I think vacation time. But his publicist said, by all means, he'll gladly come on in June. He seemed very eager to do it. So we'll discuss the relevant issues about North Carolina and the bathroom bill and discrimination, alleged discrimination issues. But I wrote a full response to his letter to me. So he wrote an article. I wrote an article responding to Montel Williams. It's on my website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. Just click on latest articles. And as always, the goal is to be constructive and redemptive. Okay, here's something really interesting. Pew Research has an article that came out 2 days ago. Five facts about Israeli Christians. Five facts about Israeli Christians. And by the picture that is posted here with the article on pewresearch.org, you can see that it's really focusing on Arab Christians, Palestinian Christians. You have a bunch of men who are carrying a cross on their shoulders in some type of apparent ritual procession. And the Good Friday procession. But here's what's fascinating. It says Christians currently make up just 2% of Israel's adult population, and they're going to tell us five interesting things about them. The fascinating part is they missed Jewish believers in Jesus. They completely and entirely missed Jewish believers in Jesus, Messianic Jews. So the Pauls and the Peters and the Miriams, Marys, of the ancient world, the Jewish followers of Jesus, Yeshua, all the first disciples, these would have been basically overlooked by Pew Research. Fascinating. Maybe I'll write an article on that. So they say, number one, the vast majority of Israelis who say they are Christian also say they are ethnically Arab. Number two, politically Christians agree with Muslims in saying Israel cannot be a democracy and a Jewish state at the same time. Interesting. Again, these are Palestinian / Arab Christians. They didn't survey the Messianic Jews. Three, Israeli Christians tend to be less religious than Israeli Muslims, but more religious than Israeli Jews. Four, Israeli Christians have limited social and family connections with Jews, as well as with Arabs from other religious groups. So basically, every single one of these takeaway points would have been different if they had brought in Messianic Jews. So Israeli Christians have limited social and family connections with Jews as well as with Arabs from other religious groups. And five, an overwhelming majority of Christians in Israel say they have been baptized. Well, that you would have had the same number with Messianic Jews. But isn't that interesting? A poll about Israeli Christians. And yeah, on the positive side is that the Messianic Jews are obviously identified as Jews and didn't come in this category. That's positive because they are Jews and they live and die as Jews. And they follow the biblical calendar and their kids fight in the Israeli army. So they are Jews. but they are Jewish followers of Jesus. Now, on the one hand, it's seamless for them, because if you believe Jesus, Yeshua, is the Jewish Messiah, then you follow him. And as a Jew, it's the right thing to do. You're not denying your Jewishness. You're not ceasing to be Jewish. One of my Israeli friends was asked years ago, how does it feel to be a Jewish convert? He said, I don't know, because it's not a sin to be Jewish. I'm a sinner. I'm a converted sinner. When he was asked how it feels to be a converted Jew, he said, I'm not. I'm a converted sinner. So yes, Messianic Jews are Jews, but Messianic Jews are followers of Jesus. And in Antioch, in the ancient world, in Acts 11th chapter, they would have been called, quote, Christians. Because Christians was not part of a new religion. Christians was not part of a non-Jewish group. Christians was meant one of these Christ ones, one of these followers of this Christ guy that was being mocked by the rest of the world. Or who is this? What are they talking about? Those were his followers. So yes, they should have been included in this survey, and it would have changed things. Now, let's just see. Let's look at this for a minute. If the adult population of Israel, just 2%, is a professing Christian. So let's just say the population is a little over 8 million, 8, 8.5 million. So you'd be talking about, let's just say you're talking about 160,000 people. So what was left out was maybe 20,000 Messianic Jews. So yes, it's a small number. And yes, it's a very small number of the 6 million Jews in Israel. So you really do feel like you're part of a very, very small minority there. And it would not have largely affected these figures. But Pew, being as thorough as it is in its surveys and the questions that it asks and the data it analyzes, it's something that at least should have been built in to the survey and explained. So I found that fascinating, personally. 866-348-7884. Here is an article by Jeffrey Salkin, posted on religiousnews.com. Martini Judaism for those who want to be shaken and stirred. That's what Jeffrey Salkin writes. Why do some mainstream churches dislike Israel? Why do some mainstream churches dislike Israel? Well, it's interesting. Salkin points out that Secretary Clinton is a lifelong member of the United Methodist Church, and the traditional denominations, still called mainstream, even though they are in the significant minority, the churches that are called mainstream, they are significantly smaller. They are significantly not mainstream. They are bleeding in terms of losing members, traditional Presbyterian churches, traditional Methodist churches. When I say traditional, I mean the large denominations. They're getting smaller and smaller. Southern Baptists are much bigger, and others that are not part of formal denominations are bigger, and many of them are growing in numbers. But what you'll find very interesting, and I've pointed to this phenomenon many times, is that the churches that become more liberal, you'll see this happen on three different fronts. Mark my words, check it out. You'll see it consistently on three different fronts. One, you'll see that they become pro-abortion. From once being pro-life, they become pro-abortion, quote, pro-choice, but ultimately pro-abortion. Two, they become pro-homosexual, quote, marriage. From recognizing marriage as God intended it and sexuality as God intended it. Instead, it becomes, the denomination, the group becomes pro-gay rights. That's how they would phrase it. And then three, they become pro-Palestinian to the point of becoming anti-Israel. Why do you think these three things go hand in hand? Now, I have friends who are committed Christians who are pro-life, pro-family, and yet, at the same time, they are also so pro-Palestinian that you could say they're anti-Israel. I have friends like that. But let me say that they are in the small minority. What you will generally see is the groups that become anti-Israel are also already pro-homosexual and pro-abortion. You'll see it with consistency. Why? To me, it's a departure from the clear, plain teaching of Scripture. To me, it's a departure from what is written, and now emotional, humanistic interpretations come in. We get away from the authority of Scripture, and we end up on the wrong side of these critically important issues. Want check it out. Get online, check the major denominations that have shifted on one of these three points. You'll almost always see they've shifted on all three. We'll be right back.
Join Dr. Michael Brown along with Messianic Jewish pastor Scott Volk for a unique behind-the-scenes tour of Israel, February 25th through March 6, 2017. Space is limited, so we're accepting applications on a first-come, first-served basis. For more information on the trip and to secure your spot, please visit our website at AskDrBrown.org and click on the Israel Tour banner or call our office at 704-782-3760.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to the Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. Ha! Yeah, here's a note from a caller. Mainline Christians do not like Jews because they don't know the Bible. 866-348-7884. Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Boy, wouldn't it be awesome if we could be in Israel together next year? It'd be the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Jerusalem, Jerusalem coming back into Jewish hands. 2017 marks the 50th anniversary. We've already had a bunch of folks sign up, so we got a great response. The trip is next year, February 25th to March 6th. And it includes all kinds of special things. I mean, we connect with Jewish believers in the land, which many tours do not do. You get to go behind the scenes with the Israeli military. You'll get to minister to kids and just be part of a real special time where kids that are deprived and in a special home and love these visits and benefit. The groups we work with donate on a regular basis to help their work there. And then all the special places, the historic sites, the biblical sites, it's really quite exceptional. And then some nights you can join me if you like as I do live radio from Israel. We're able to do that as well. And we've got, you know, immersions in the River Jordan and stuff. It's just wonderful. I have to tell you honestly that when we did the tour 2 years ago, I talked about it on the radio. I pushed it. But I thought, you know, it's a lot of money to go to Israel, and I'm always jealous for your funds and making sure that your needs are met and things like that. And I knew it would be impacting. But once I was there, I thought, what? This is a deal. I can't believe everything everybody's getting, and the accommodations and the food and the quality of the tour. So I thought, man, next time around, I'm going to tell everybody, you need to be there. If there's a way to do it, you need to do it. But then the other thing was how deeply impacted people were. I knew they'd be impacted. I just didn't realize it would be that deep. Well, I heard it from one after another, because I'd never personally been part of leading a tour. I didn't see it firsthand like that. So join us if you can. The sooner you get your applications in, the better. Go to AskDrBrown, AskDrBrown.org, and click right on the homepage. You'll see the banner, and you can get involved there. Okay, before we go to the phones, I was listening to the autobiography of Reinhard Bonnke. I have his book on A Life of Fire. But a friend of mine said, do yourself a favor and get the Audible book and listen to him reading his own bio. And it's a whole different dimension. That's all I can tell you. A whole different dimension. And he's talking about his father. The Bonnke family were displaced refugees for a few years because of World War II. They had to flee to Denmark for their lives. And Bonnke's father was a soldier, was an officer in the German army. Now, he had never joined the Nazis, but he was a soldier in the German army. He had no idea, as many Germans, he had no idea about Hitler's final solution until towards the end of the war. And when he realized, when he realized that he was fighting for a country that was trying to exterminate the Jewish people, he was mortified. Now, this is of course 1945, the end of the war, and his dad lives many years after that. But Reinhard Bonnke said that for the rest of his life, it troubled his dad that he did what he did as a German in the army. That he was part of that. It troubled him the rest of his life. And for his dad, it was simple. As a believer in Scripture, that the Jewish people were God's chosen people through whom the Messiah came. And therefore, he as a Christian loved the Jewish people, loved the people of Israel. That was just a given. It doesn't mean everything Jews do is right. It doesn't mean everything the Jewish people do should be backed by Christians. It doesn't mean everything the nation of Israel does is right. Israel has problems like every other country. Israel has issues like every other country. We understand that. At the same time, we recognize that God has kept his hand on the Jewish people, that those he scattered, he has regathered. There is no other logical, historical explanation, especially if you believe in the Scriptures. The only explanation is he who scattered has regathered. And therefore, as much as we care about justice for the Palestinians, as much as we want to see fair treatment of everyone in the Middle East, we recognize God's hand involved. It is both prophetic reality and justice that we stand for. If you have one of these so-called mainstream denominations that has gone away from Scripture and has become increasingly liberal, they will hold Israel to a higher standard on the one hand. On the other hand, they will not factor in the larger narrative and will pretty much buy the radical anti-Israel, radical pro-Palestinian narrative, in which case Israel becomes the evil occupier. I have a whole lecture, you can watch it for free on YouTube. Is Israel an evil occupier? Oh, you should see some of the comments posted on YouTube, vilifying me, attacking me, using profanity, every kind of unclean thing. We have to remove those because they violate our guidelines, but we'll often take a screenshot of them just to preserve them. The level of hatred, animosity coming my way for simply giving the history. Wow. 866-34-TRUTH. All right, let's go to Fort Mill, South Carolina. John, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yeah, how are you? Good afternoon. Yeah, I have two quick questions. I wrote them down. Should we say that Jews are members of a race or followers of religion? And the second question is, are the modern Jews today and the ancient Israelites one and the same people?
Okay, great questions. The answer to the first question is a bit more complex. Jews are Jews ethnically, and many practice Judaism. Okay? So, if you're a traditional Jew, to be a Jew is to be a practitioner of Judaism. And to be an atheist Jew or a Buddhist Jew or a Jewish Christian is a denial of your Jewishness. They'd still say you're a Jew. They would tell me I'm a baptized Jew, but I'm not living out my Jewishness. But technically, you can be an atheistic Jew, in which case, yes, in fact, you're still a Jew. So there is the practitioner of Judaism, and then there is someone that is an ethnic Jew. And yes, ethnically, ultimately, is how we're going to be marked. The problem is an ethnic Jew that separates from Judaism entirely within a few generations would normally totally assimilate. As for Israel, yes, the Jewish people today are by and large descendants of ancient Israelites. However, there's been much intermarriage over the centuries and conversion into Judaism. So the great majority, we could say yes, trace back to the ancient Israelites. However, there have been others who are not part of Israel who have been added in and become part of the larger Jewish people over the centuries.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to the Line of Fire on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown, delighted to be with you. 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call. Sometimes I get asked about the Niturei Karta. You say, who are the Niturei Karta? That's Aramaic for keepers of the city. They are ultra-Orthodox Jews, mainly based in New York and in Israel, who vehemently oppose the modern state of Israel. They believe it's an abomination. They believe it's a cause of anti-Semitism and problems around the world. They believe it is hindering the coming of the Messiah. And because they will sometimes be seen protesting with the Palestinian side, or even most notoriously joining at a conference in Iran and appearing on Iran state TV, that they give the impression that they speak for many Jews around the world. They are really a hated micro-minority by the vast majority of the rest of the Jewish population. And even traditional Jews like the Satmar Hasidim, who are dwarf them in numbers, the Satmar Hasidim, who do not believe in the modern state of Israel, they were still upset that these people appeared on Iranian TV, on Islamic TV, feeling it brought reproach to the Jewish people as a whole. That being said, there are a healthy number of traditional Jews, ultra-Orthodox as well, who do oppose the modern state of Israel, and they opposed it in the early Zionist movement days as well as today. They said that only the Messiah can regather the Jewish people, that a Jewish state would create hatred towards the Jewish people, and that, God forbid, in their mind, it would be a secular state and not a Torah-based state, which would be the worst thing for Jewish people because it would lead them to apostasy. Now, you could say many of their concerns prove valid. On the flip side, my standpoint, only God can be credited with the regathering. There's no logical way that it can explain it scripturally if God scattered, how the Jewish people would have the power to regather themselves or how the nations could simply do it. So I have a major problem based on that. And then, look, what about all the Jew hatred leading in the Holocaust and the attempt to exterminate Jews? The idea of a Jewish homeland now became very important. But just so you know, there are these dissenting views out there. 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Long Island. Mary, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Oh, hi, Dr. Brown. Thank you for taking my call. You are an inspiration. You are amazing. I met you in Bethlehem Assemblies of God in Valley Stream quite a while ago. You signed a book. But you are full of knowledge, and you keep going, and I just love you. I have a question. I'm a Christian, a born-again Christian, and recently I was at a seminar, and I had gotten a prayer shawl. It was from a contribution. And just recently, just a few weeks ago, I got a shofar. Now, I love these items, and I know what they represent for the Jewish people, and I love the Jewish people. And I feel like, as a Christian, I'm actually, the deeper I get in my faith, I know God. I'm feeling God's love for them, and it's so beautiful. So I acquired these two items, but yet in my mind as a Christian, I'm going, and I'm just thinking to myself, is this idolatry as a Christian? I love watching the Jewish Jesus also on the Christian Network, and he is an all, and you, oh my God, Messianic Jews are the best. They have a love that I'm starting to learn about with God that is awesome, and I love it. So I didn't realize what I had received was called a prayer shawl. I have a friend who actually, in Hebrew, there was some language on it, and he said this is what it's called. It's called a prayer shawl, because there were scriptures that had English, and I read those.
Tell you what, stay there. Stay there. I'll address this on the other side of the break. Right, phone lines are jammed. I'm going to get to every one of your calls if I can. So stay right there. And Mary, thank you for the kind words. We'll be right back.
God of light, hear our cry. Send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to The Line of Fire. This is 30 Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown, delighted to be with you. 866-34-TRUTH with your Jewish-related calls. So within the last few days, Holocaust Remembrance Day, followed by Independence Day in Israel. And never forget that the modern state of Israel was birthed out of the ashes of the Holocaust. And without trying to explain the agonizing questions that are raised by the Holocaust, we see once again that life comes out of death. That is often the way that God works and moves. So I want to go back to Mary on Long Island. As far as a prayer shawl, let me just give you the origins of that. In the scriptures, Jewish men, not women, Jewish men were commanded to wear garments that would, they were four-cornered garments that are just the traditional garment a man would wear. But on the corners, they were to have these ritual fringes with this deep blue, it's a blue-purple color, and called Tehelet. And that was to remind them that they were to keep the commandments of God. Well, over the centuries, a couple things happened. The rabbis had determined that there was only one particular dye that could get that particular color, and it came from a particular snail, Chilazon, and they couldn't get that snail anymore. They're no longer able to find that snail. So instead, they said, all right, we just make the fringes white. Now, this is many, many centuries later. Also, the garments changed. Men didn't dress like that. It wasn't like the robe-type garment where you could have a four-cornered thing. So what traditional Jewish men then did is put what's called a talit katan. What you have, the prayer shawl, is the talit. This talit katan, this is worn under the men's shirt. It's kind of like almost like a T-shirt type thing. And then it has, but it's got the four corners, and it has the fringes in white. And then they are to wear those outside of their slacks. So they have a shirt over that, but they're to wear those outside of their slacks. So they every day see those fringes and they're reminded, I'm a Jew, I have to keep the commandments. So this is over a period of centuries. Now, what do you do if you're a traditional Jewish man and you go in the synagogue to pray? Well, now you put the prayer shawl on, and this is now the outward adorning, and then certain men would pray with it covering their heads. And the Hebrew on it blesses the Lord who commanded us to wear that. Now, that's not really totally accurate, because what God commanded was the ritual fringes, but it's kind of tied in with the prayer shawl now. Mm-hmm. If you can find something that draws you in closeness to Israel, okay, and gives you a sense of identification with the Jewish people through the shofar and through the prayer shawl. It helps you pray for the salvation of Jewish people. It helps you remember the ultimate Jewish roots of our faith. Wonderful. That's great. If it becomes kind of this holy item or this sacred thing where, you know, you can't worship or pray without it, or you try to do it to make yourself feel like a Jew even though you're not a Jew, then in that sense, it becomes idolatrous and unhealthy.
Okay,
but
great.
It can be something very healthy and very wonderful. Look, there are traditional Jews, one rabbi in particular, who's asked me when we've been together a couple of times, would I put on tefillin, the phylacteries, the prayer boxes? Now, that's based on Deuteronomy 6 and some other passages, or Exodus 12, where you have you write these words on your hearts and, you know, have them between your eyes and things like that. Mm-hmm. And traditional Jews have interpreted that literally. So right. When they pray in the morning, except for the Sabbath, they put these on. And so I've had, did Jesus wear them or not? Some would say, of course he did. Others would say, no, it's debatable. Right. But I've been asked sometimes by a traditional rabbi, will I put on tefillin and pray with them? I said, sure, but I won't say the prayer that I was commanded to put these on, because I don't believe God commanded these specifically. And he said, fine, just pray what you want to pray. It's very moving to me. It identifies me deeply with my people, but there's nothing idolatrous about it. So You know your heart with that. The key thing is that Yeshua is always central. And to the extent he's central, then everything else will be clear. Hey, thank you for the call. By the way, if you don't have my book, 60 Questions Christians Ask About Jewish Beliefs and Practices, 60 Questions Christians Ask About Jewish Beliefs and Practices, you'll find a lot of relevant info in that book. All right, thank you for the call. Let's go to Gambrills, Maryland. Harry, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Michael Brown. I love your show.
Thank you.
I'm a first-time caller, so I'm a little nervous.
Hey, it's just the two of us, just a little chat on the phone. We're good.
Okay, good. Anyway, I ran across YouTube, Rabbi Kaduri. Have you ever heard his name before?
Yes, of course. Sure.
Okay, and anyway, he died, and he left a note that who the Messiah would be, and somebody was supposed to open up that note like a year after he had died, and
yep.
He opened it up, and it had the name Yehoshua,
mm-hmm.
and which is Jesus' name for the Messiah's name, and I was wondering, is there any validity to that, or is that, I mean, what are your thoughts on that? It was kind of interesting to me when I first saw it.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and I'm gonna give you the stories on both sides. Okay,
I'll give
you the pro Jesus and the anti Jesus interpretations. Rabbi Yitzchak Kaduri was one of the most esteemed ultra Orthodox rabbis in Israel and the world, who specialized in Jewish mysticism. So this is the study of the Zohar, the Kabbalah, things like that, esoteric in many, many ways. And he died somewhere around the age of 107. I don't know if we know his exact age, but he was an old, old, revered man. And yes, he did leave a note and claimed that he had seen the Messiah or met the Messiah. So was it a mystical encounter or something? You know, these things widely discussed and debated. And what happened was this note is opened 1 year later, and it's a sentence. But the first letter of each word spells out Yehoshua. And this allegedly was giving the identity of the Messiah. And Yehoshua is Joshua, which is the full name for Yeshua, Jesus. So this created an uproar. And many Messianic Jews began to report on this. And it spread rapidly around the world. So the initial reports, everything I read, was completely legitimate. And was this a hint of him saying that Jesus is actually the Messiah, which of course would create complete uproar in that community. It would be like all the top Christian leaders in America saying Muhammad is actually the Savior. You know, it'd be that radical kind of a thing. Since then, his son, who's obviously an old man also, repudiated it. No, this wasn't real. Or others said, no, it wasn't really his writing. And now counter-missionary groups are denying the whole thing. So I've had friends in Israel who told me they investigated it and it's real. But I can't verify it. That's all I can say. I can't verify it. I have friends who absolutely vouch for it. And that's all I can say. That it could well be, and I do expect, Harry, in the coming years, that more and more ultra-Orthodox Jews will become followers of Jesus Yeshua. I expect that more and more ultra-Orthodox Jews will be recognizing Jesus Yeshua as the Messiah, and this kind of thing will happen even more. So I can't verify it, but it could very well be 100% true. Fascinating, isn't it? All right, thank you, sir, for the question. Much appreciated. We go to Philip in Margate, Florida. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown, how are you, sir?
Doing very well, thank you.
Good. I got a question about the Tanakh compared to our old Christian, the Old Testament Christian Bible.
Yes.
I just purchased the Tanakh, and I noticed that the wording is a little different, so I had researched it. And from my understanding is that our Old Testament is translated from the Septuagint, and that the Tanakh is translated from the Masoretic text. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct.
Okay.
All are translated primarily from the Masoretic text. Okay. In other words, the they're all translated from the same Hebrew. Some Christian translations rely more on the Septuagint than others, but basically any English translation you read, we're all starting with the Hebrew text, the Masoretic text. The reason the wording's different, and the order of some of the books is different, the reason the wording is different is it's a different faith perspective and a different style of translation. That's all. But it's the same Hebrew text, the same Masoretic textual tradition. Everyone is starting with that, using the Septuagint in a secondary way. You'll even see that in the notes in the Tanakh, the New Jewish version. So the wording is different because it's Jewish scholars versus Christian scholars, a different faith tradition, all right, as well as different translation approach. But the same fundamental text is being used in both. Hey, gotta run. Thank you.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Brother was born Yeshua from the kingly tribe of Judah. Came the promise ruler, brought truth and gave sight to the blind and strength to the lame.
Chazakim, exalting Yeshua, hip-hop rap used for the glory of the Lord. 866-34-TRUTH on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. A few news items and then straight back to the phones. Aaron Klein reported this on Breitbart yesterday. Iran's press TV fails to fix false report claiming Saudi king gave $80 million to Netanyahu's election campaign. Do you hear that? They reported that in March 2015, King Salman has deposited $80 million to support Netanyahu's campaign via a Syrian Spanish person named Mohammed Ayed Kayali. Of course, it's complete nonsense, bunk. But does Press TV, Iran State TV, fix that? Why would they fix that? And let's remember, it's not just an Israel issue. Saudi Arabia is the world Sunni power, okay, or one of the great Sunni powers. And Iran is the great Shiite power in Islam, so they are in conflict. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Long Island. Ramon, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown, how are you doing today?
Very well, thank you.
All right, I want to comment about something, but I also have a question for you when I'm done. I just want to say that the supposed traditional mainstream church, when they said they believe they support homosexuality, they support abortion, they don't like Jews, they can say whatever they want to say. They can call themselves Christian, but we know they're not. You know.
The so-called mainstream churches that have so radically departed from their faith traditions and biblical standards, many of them would deny the literality of the resurrection. I mean, that's how far they've gone from the faith. So absolutely true.
Yeah, and they don't believe in prophecy because prophecy is hard to be fulfilled. You know, Israel came back to be a nation back in 1948 or 1947, right? That is a miracle on its own right there. And the question I have for you, Dr. Brown, is there a documentary or something that gives information on, when Israel stopped being a nation, stopped existing as a nation before they came back, who took them out of the land? I imagine it was a war, right? But who kicked the Jews out of Israel?
Yeah, I mean, there are documentaries on the history of Israel. But in point of fact, historically, the Jews were scattered over centuries. Ramon, if you go back all the way to the 8th century B.C., in 721, Samaria was destroyed by the Assyrians, and many members of the 10 tribes, the 10 northern tribes, were scattered around the world. Some stayed, some fled south, but many others were scattered. Then 586 B.C., with the destruction of Jerusalem and the bringing of tens of thousands of Jews into exile in Babylon, you have a further scattering. Now, many come back, but many don't. Then, with the first major Jewish revolt, 66 to 74 AD, so this is over 1900 years ago, as a result of the battle against Rome, there were Jewish deportations, but primarily the second Jewish revolt, especially 132 to 135, Jews banished from Jerusalem at that point and scattered once again out of the land of Israel. So it was successive. It was the Assyrians and then the Babylonians and then the Romans. So the Jews were put in exile, but there was always a Jewish presence in the land, even if it was small. And for a more recent time frame, check out my lecture on YouTube, Was Israel an Evil Occupier? Hey, thank you for the question. Much appreciated. 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Andrew in Queens, New York. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. I have a question for you. We know that there's the Jews today. In the past, they were called Judeans. But whatever happened to all the other tribes? How come we only hear about the tribe of Judah and we don't hear about all the other tribes that existed?
Yes, sir.
As Israel.
Three answers for you.
Yes.
One is we still know about the tribe of Levi. In fact, many people whose last name is Levi or then Cohen, more particularly would be the priestly family within that, those are most likely descendants from the tribe of Levi. So we still hear about them. That's one thing. Number two,
okay.
Because of the exiling of many of the 10 northern tribes, those that survived became part of Judah. So many of the 10 tribes merged together with the kingdom of Judah, and then this became part of the Judeans. So Paul can reference the 12 tribes of Israel in the book of Acts, and Jacob, James, in his book, references the 12 tribes scattered abroad. So among the Judean people, the Jewish people, are representatives of all 12 tribes, although many could not trace that back, for sure. But then the third question, the third part of the answer is that actually there are lost tribes out there, not whole tribes, but parts of lost tribes. There are Jews or Israelites, I should say, to be more precise, Andrew, as your question was properly precise. There are Israelites who are scattered in different parts of the world who have been lost to history. But every so often you find out about a group that has continued to have Jewish practices, say in Africa. And some have even had DNA testing that verifies that they seem to go back to ancient Israel. So they're out there, but apparently they're just small pockets here and there of the remnants. So number one, we still have many who recognize their descendants of the tribe of Levi. Number two, most of what remains of the 10 tribes would have been joined together with the Judeans, hence part of the larger, quote, Jewish people. And then lastly, there are scattered remnants of the lost tribes around the world, it appears. And obviously they've intermarried, they now look like the peoples where they are, but they have maintained their traditions in many cases as Israelites. But they don't know what the rabbis taught. Why? Because what the rabbis taught came much later. Thank you for asking. Again, I appreciate that. All right, friends, we are out of time. Let me encourage you to check out our Israel tour. To check out our Israel tour, and this will be the second that we have ever done, and we're more excited about this one than the first one, once we saw the impact it had on folks. So by all means, go to the website, askdrbrown.org, check out our latest videos, articles, audio, and right on the homepage, check out the Israel banner. If you could join us, it'll be the trip of a lifetime. It's next year, but now, trust me, it comes up before you know it. Now's the time to get your deposit in, and we'll be there, God willing, February 25th to March 6th is the trip. My bottom line today, God continues to be jealous over the well-being and fate of the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Would you join with him by praying for the Jewish people? It is your Thoroughly Jewish host on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Let's do it.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
The sound of the Shofar Blast on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, the sound that commemorates Israel Independence Day, just this week, 50 years of the State of Israel. The Palestinians mark it as what they call Al-Nakba, the disaster, the destruction. Jews celebrated it as the day of independence for God returning the Jewish people to land and giving us a sovereign state once again. I've got two authors I'm going to be speaking with in a few minutes about an important new book about Israel, especially reaching out to the millennial generation, the younger generation that doesn't seem to have the same appreciation for Israel, the same recognition of Israel's importance. And it's important that we understand that. It's important that we are able to speak to the younger generation about Israel, because here's an important perspective, all right? The older generation would have this, the younger would not. The modern state of Israel is literally birthed out of the ashes of the Holocaust. Jewish population in Israel last year reached 6 million people, and that was significant because that was the rough number of Jews who perished in the Holocaust, 6 million out of 9 million Jews, so two-thirds of the Jewish population. Holocaust Remembrance Day is just a few days before Israel Independence Day. There was a consciousness of the older generation of the miracle of modern Israel. There was a consciousness of the older generation of how God himself had restored a Jewish nation in his mercy. There was a consciousness of the horrors of anti-Semitism, the horrors of Jew hatred, how the world sat by either ignorantly or indifferently as two-thirds of European Jews were slaughtered. There were many Christians who were grieved over this and recognized how bad theology in the church had opened up the door to these horrors. And otherwise, it could not have happened in Europe. This could not have possibly happened in Europe without some level of historic anti-Semitism in the church. All these things were recognized, and the Muslim attempt, the surrounding Arab nations attempting to destroy the Jewish people, wipe them out. The world could see how this fledgling nation was able to fight back. It lost, like, I think, one out of 100 people were killed in the 1948 war. I mean, you're talking about very, very high casualty figures, and somehow Israel survives, and then the miracle of the Six-Day War. We witness all these things. We see them happen. We recognize their uniqueness. We saw the hand of God, but you have a younger generation that doesn't have that historical perspective. You have a younger generation that has focused on a micro narrative and missed the macro. They focused on, well, why is a wall there separating families and hurting these poor Palestinian Christians? And why is this fence there? Without recognizing that the wall was built to keep snipers out, the fence was built to keep terrorists out. And that this is the result not of Israel, this is the result of radical Islam and its policies and the failure to fight against these by the Muslim leadership of Palestinian Authority and Hamas. In fact, there's often the flaming them, fanning them into flame. So what we need is a larger narrative and a truthful narrative that can reach the younger generation. We come back. I'm going to speak with Michael Onifer and Joshua Charles, an important new book on Israel. In fact, important enough that I wrote the foreword to it. We'll be right back with Michael and Joshua.
Fire we please, send the fire. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown, and I am speaking with Michael Onifer and Joshua Charles, who have written an important book, especially for millennials, about God, Israel, and you. And as I said in the lead-in to this in the last segment, what the older generation of Christians, evangelical Christians, almost took for granted, love for Israel, prayer for Israel, recognition of the modern state of Israel as being an act of God. The younger generation of Christians often doesn't have that. In fact, they see things from a very different perspective. Michael Onifer founded the Bethlehem Project, leadership development job creation program for Palestinian Christians. He's lived in Israel on multiple occasions and travels to Israel and the West Bank regularly. Joshua Charles is the co-author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, The Original Argument, and the recent Amazon bestseller, Liberty's Secrets, Lost Wisdom of America's Founders. So I'm going to bring on together Michael and Joshua. Gentlemen, you know what? I somehow lost Michael right there. Betsy, I don't know what happened there, but lost him there. So Joshua, welcome to the Line of Fire. We'll reconnect with Michael in a moment.
Sure. Well, thanks, Dr. Brown. I always love being on.
Yeah. Now we've had you on before to talk about America, to talk about American history, Constitution, those kinds of things. Where does the interest in Israel come from?
Well, actually, I was going on a program that Michael directed. That's how he and I met initially in the summer of 2013. I can't believe it's been that long already. But it was the Israel Experience College Scholarship Program, and the point of it was to take young, emerging Christian leaders over to Israel, and the mantra of the program is to give them an educated heart for Israel. So we went over there, I think it was about a three-week trip, and, you know, we saw the typical tourist stuff, but we also got to see a bunch of stuff that you usually don't see. So, for example, we visited a town on the border of the Gaza Strip called Sderot. You're probably quite familiar with it. It gets hit by rockets quite a bit whenever Hamas does their thing. And so, you know, an example of something that we saw that most people don't see when they go to Israel is, you know, a child's playground with a big old, you know, caterpillar type thing made out of cement. It's meant to look fun and, you know, childlike for kids. But it's, you know, the outside cement barrier is 3 feet thick, something like that. It's like this tube. And inside the tube, there were these orange lines that were indicating to the children visually that they needed to be within those lines if there were rocket attacks. So it was a really, it was made to look childlike and innocent, and it was. It was to play for the kids, you know, hide and seek, whatever. But in the event it needed to be, it was instantly converted into a missile shelter.
And this
was really sobering, and we met with numerous officials. I mean, all sorts of stuff that you just don't get to see normally.
Yes, and in Sderot, literally, you have 15 seconds to get to a bomb shelter as bombs are
raid
in. So we're reconnecting with Michael. I'm not sure what happened. Maybe Joshua just won a little extra airtime. But Michael, welcome to the line. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. It's good to be with you.
Yes. Yeah, so interestingly, Joshua's interest in Israel and heart for this project comes from being part of what you're doing. So Michael, let's be really plain about this. Most of the people who are doing things like, you know, Bethlehem Project, name Bethlehem in there, and working to help Palestinian Christians, they often seem to be on the Israel bashing side, or the conferences like Christ at the Checkpoint, where Israel is made into the evil occupier in the eyes of many of the speakers there, where it's big bad Israel and the poor Palestinians, and yet you care very much about the Palestinians and work with them, yet you've written a book to sensitize Christians, especially young people, about the importance of Israel. How do these two things grow up in the same soil of one heart?
Well, it's because it originates from the heart of God. And Joshua and I met on the Israel Experience Program working with young people and talking to them about Israel. And, you know, there is a warranted concern about the next generation and their position, my generation, our position towards Israel. But I've been very encouraged that young people like Josh and others that have come with me to Israel, when we talk to them about Israel from the context of God's heart and from the context of the knowledge of the person of Jesus, Israel isn't that much of an issue. And when you begin with the main thing and keep it the main thing, then you can deal with some of the complexities with Israel. And that's why I easily arrived at a place where I am pro-Israel and pro-Palestinian, in the sense that I want the best for the Palestinian people, and I want to see the Palestinians released into their redemptive purpose.
All right, so for you, it's not a conflict. It's not a challenge. How can you love the modern state of Israel, the Jewish people, and the Palestinians at the same time? It's the same heart of God.
It's not a conflict, but it's hard work.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people don't want to do that work. They don't want to wrestle with ultimately becomes paradoxes of the kingdom of God. They don't want to wrestle with issues like the wrath of God, something that you've gone to lengths to talk about. That, you know, I was so glad you did the monster God debate in Kansas City and that you're talking about these issues, because that's what happens. You know, when you touch Israel, when you touch the apple of God's eye, you begin to dive into places where you have to wrestle with God, just like Jacob before he was called Israel.
All right,
so it's not a conflict, but it's difficult.
All right, so let's think this through together here. And Josh, I'll jump back to you for
sure.
A moment. And I don't know if one of you guys is in a kitchen or a restaurant or something, but it sounds like maybe you need a little help putting the dishes away from the dishwasher, but we'll try to figure out what the background noise is.
I don't know.
All right, yeah, we're all trying to sort out. It's not me. Here, I've got my bottle of water and my papers and my keyboard here and mouse. So, not sure what that is, but anyway, Joshua, you're a sharp guy. You're doing research day and night on historical American documents and things like that. However, we've got to break this down to sound bites now. What Michael's saying is absolutely true. These are deep theological issues. But what about the fact that we got to reduce this to sound bites for the younger generation? And one thing that you've talked about, Josh, is free Palestine or free the Palestinians. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is multiple things, and it actually is, it's intended to express in a very short, pithy way something that many people would immediately assume is one thing, but in fact is something else. And so the point is, when you're in the West Bank and you're talking with a lot of Palestinians, and I don't claim any of these things are completely absent on the Israeli side, but there are a lot of prejudices that work, and there's vast historical ignorance. I met with some leaders in Bethlehem one time, and some of them were Christians, and some of them were Muslims, and some from Fatah. They literally had Hamas on the phone. They were going to try and have them talk with us. They didn't, because the IDF was on the prowl for them. This was when the three Israeli teenagers had just been murdered a few summers ago. And, you know, they were we were talking about the narrative. I was there just to listen. I wasn't there to debate with them. I was just there to get information. And we're talking about, you know, how their version of events, essentially, the Palestinian narrative as they saw it. And what I discovered was they left out something very, very important, namely the Arab invasion in 1948. And I asked them, I was like, well, what about the Arab invasion of 1948? You know, because they were just saying Israel took everything, blah, blah, blah. And they looked at me with zero idea of what I was talking about. And I said, the Arabs invaded in 1948 after Israel declared it. I mean, these are just basic facts. You can look up anywhere. And they had zero idea what I was talking about. And anyway, it developed from there into, you know, a moral justification of the suicide bombing of civilians. Even I'm very, very sad and was very distressed to see by Christians. And who had no doubt, one of them had lost a daughter, and I grieve with them, but to go from that step to, you know, justifying the suicide bombing of Jewish civilians, of Israeli civilians, it was utterly strange to me. So there's many different things that are going on in Palestinian culture that they quite frankly need to be freed of. And but also, I've met a number of young Palestinians. One of them is my friend Mutaz, who Michael has met, and we've actually been able to introduce to other multiple young people. I actually had one group meet with him on Saturday and another group meeting with him in a few days. And our meeting just happened to be a chance meeting, but he was a waiter when I went on the Israel experience with Michael, and we talked with him. And so I didn't tell anybody I was going to ask this question, but I just said, hey, Mutaz, come over here. He said, okay. He was very anti-Israel, but I said, so what are your thoughts on Israel? And the whole table just froze up, whatever. But it actually ended up being an extremely good conversation. Long story short, he and I stayed in touch, developed a friendship. I've seen him every single year I've gone back since. I'll be going my fourth time this year, and every single time. And his heart has totally changed. I'd love to talk about that a little bit.
Got a break here. Dialogue is important, but Palestinians need to be freed from Islamic propaganda and revisionist propaganda. We need to have compassion in that respect.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Oh boy. You say, what in the world was that? That was the 8th annual Childhood Festival hosted by the Islamic Association in Khan Yunis, Gaza. And it features children simulating acts of defiance against Israeli soldiers and policemen. In the play, a girl dressed as a veiled Palestinian woman pushes an Israeli policeman in defiance while weapons are trained on her. Children throw stones at, quote, policemen. This was the young Palestinian girl, what you just heard, saying, hurry up, my child, and join the battle. Die as a martyr and blow up the enemies. Palestine is an Arab clasping victory in one hand, stones of fire in the other, an Arab filled with challenge, pride, and resolve. This is part of what Palestinians are taught, especially in a place like Gaza. My guests, Michael Onifer and Joshua Charles, authors of the new book, God, Israel, and You. So, Michael, you work in Bethlehem. You help Palestinian Christians. To what degree is this type of propaganda, this type of Jew hatred or Israel hatred, part of Palestinian culture?
It's inescapable. And you mentioned something very important at the last break at the very end, and you said the word compassion. And we need to have compassion for the Palestinian people. And in that compassion, we need to understand that they have grown up in an environment where they have very limited opportunities to come to any other conclusion than hating Israel and the Jewish people. Even those who are in the minority of the minority of the minority that go to churches that actually teach the Old Testament and have a favorable position towards Israel, they still are believing a false narrative, as you were talking about earlier. They're believing a historical and political narrative that's divorced from all the facts on the ground. It's a big deal, and the Palestinians really need to be freed from the oppression of their own leaders.
And Michael, in God, Israel, and You, again, there are a number of books out on Israel. I found there are unique things that you had to say in this, especially the young generation. Why would a young person want to read this, and what are you hoping to happen when they do read it?
I'm hoping what it's going to do is encourage them to take some courageous steps to begin to think critically about what's happening in Israel. And the reason why it's so vital for them to do that is because the way that we understand Israel and the Jewish people eventually dictates how we understand the realities of covenant, which eventually informs how we relate to God himself. If we miss Israel, we run the risk of chasing after a Western Jesus who's not real, and we can miss the creator of the universe who wants to co-labor with us in the earth.
Yeah, that's serious. That's significant. Joshua, as how old are you?
I am 20. I just turned 28.
Just turned 28. Okay. I knew it was somewhere around 27, so you've graduated to 28. Good, good. All right.
Yeah.
Your peers, say folks under 30, Christians, what misconceptions do you see that they have about Israel, the Palestinians? What are you trying to adjust in God, Israel, and you in terms of these misperceptions?
Well, the biggest misperception, I'd say it's more of a worldview issue, and Michael really addressed this extremely well, is the issue of, do you look at life as your story to tell to the world, or do you look at it as finding out what God's story is and getting involved in the midst of it? And so when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian issue, many young people are prone to, if they care about it at all, which if they care about it at all, that's usually a step forward. But if they care about it at all, they see it as essentially a fight between David and Goliath. But ironically, the Israelis have become Goliath, and the
yep.
Palestinians have become David. And so, the reason why Michael likes to readjust the worldview here is that if God is in covenant with the Jewish people, that doesn't mean everything they do is perfect. As Deuteronomy makes very clear, God, you know, I chose you because you were not because you were the greatest, but because you were the least and whatnot. And so when you adjust the view to what is God doing in the earth, it becomes a much less me-centric view of God, a much less me-centric view of purpose. And for me, this became very clear when I visited Egypt. I've been there several times now, seeing these amazing buildings. And it just struck me that you have this civilization, which in the grand sweep of, you know, the last 5,000-6,000 years of human history, has probably on balance been the most powerful civilization that ever existed. And yet, who remembers their gods? Who remembers, passages from the Book of the Dead? Yet, if you were to say hallelujah, or even if you know Jesus, you know, the most famous Jew of all time, that came from the little band of beleaguered slaves that came out of that civilization that, relatively speaking, have had an exceptionally small amount of power, and yet their God, their language is still spoken, their God is still known all over the world. A person in South Korea knows hallelujah just as much as someone in North America and South America. I mean, the God of the Jews, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has gone everywhere. The gods of the Egyptians are utterly forgotten. Their pharaohs are utterly forgotten. And that is, from a historical perspective, exceptionally, you know, to use a very academic term, weird. And and so seeing that reality, I think, is the biggest adjustment, that God is telling a story first and foremost. And do you want your life to be about you expressing what's inside of you and your story, or finding out the story God's telling and becoming a part of it?
All right. So what you gentlemen are saying is really important for our listeners to grasp. This, the struggle that today's young people, especially younger Christians, have with seeing Israel in the right perspective is that it is part of the larger narrative of the younger generation. With all of its good qualities, it has its bad qualities. And one is, it's often me-centric. The narrative begins with, this is who I am, and this is how I feel. So if you start with that, and then you start with stories, say Palestinian stories and things like that, that are also me-centric, you will not get God's larger picture. And if you really want to help the individual, the me, if you really want to help the individual, you need to get God's overall perspective. Hey, Michael, Joshua, I want to keep you on for a few more minutes, but a quick question, Michael, as we've got 45 seconds, what's the greatest impact on the lives of the people that come with you on one of your Israel experiences?
I think it's being able to connect the dots between what's happening in Israel today and the person of Jesus. When I see a young person understand that their heartfelt, sincere devotion to Jesus can be significantly influenced by understanding what's happening in Israel today.
Mm. That's powerful. Again, friends, I hope you're hearing, this is not, we love Israel, Israel, Israel. This is, we love God. We love God. And therefore, we have these perspectives. The authors, Michael Onifer, together with Joshua Charles, the book, God, Israel, and You. In particular, get into the hands of younger Christians, millennial Christians. It's essential reading for them. We'll be right back.
Change the world.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown, 866-34-TRUTH, the number to call. If you have a Jewish-related question for me, if you have a question relating to Israel, the Jewish people, Hebrew language, Jewish tradition, give me a call, 866-34-TRUTH. First, I want to speak with Michael Onifer, author of an important new book, God, Israel, and You, together with co-author Joshua Charles. I wrote the foreword to this book. Why? Because it's important reading for millennial Christians, younger Christians who do not seem to have the same heart for Israel that the older generation does. I have done meetings, different parts of the world and around America, Israel-related meetings, and invariably the crowd is older than other meetings. So the older generation seems to get things that the younger generation does not. Let me go first to you, Michael, and ask this. As you have brought Christians over, young people, they've seen Israel, you bring them over to the West Bank, you show them the work you're doing to help Palestinian Christians, do they still come away with that sense of awe that other Christians do when they go to Israel for the first time and they kind of see the Bible coming to life in front of their eyes? Do they still get that? Is it lessened by you showing them what you're doing among the Palestinians as well?
No, I think the opposite is true. I think it elevates the experience, because what it does is it takes the experience outside of this realm of religious romanticism and it connects them to the affairs of their life. Because too often you can go on this kind of sterilized, you know, trip to Israel, which is wonderful, which every Christian should do. But there's an element to it that is very safe and very controlled, and you don't talk about the real things that are going on. And I found that when you talk to a young person about what's happening in Israel and you invite them to consider the complexities of the security situation and what's happening with Palestinians, they actually get on board with supporting Israel a lot faster than going about it a different way. And that's what the book does. We don't whitewash Israel in any sense. What we do is we identify the reality that Scripture is full of individuals and nations that were flawed but used by God. And you have a Christian body today, a part of the Christian body today, that's trying to write Israel out of God's redemptive purposes because of what they're doing wrong as a nation. And that simply doesn't agree with the narrative of Scripture.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, the book, God, Israel, and You, highly recommended, especially to younger Christians, especially 30 and younger. Josh, we've got a little over a minute, but share your heart with me for reconciliation, Jewish believers, Palestinian Christians coming together as one. Share your heart with me about that.
Well, I have seen it happen with my own eyes. The friend of mine I told you about earlier, Mutaz, he's a Palestinian. When I first met him, he was rabidly anti-Israel. He's a Muslim as well. To this day, he's a Muslim. But we've been able to introduce him to a few people, and the reactions have really been extraordinary. The longer I've known him, he's kind of awakened to the fact that he would rather be a citizen of Israel. He would rather, you know, his father was arrested by the Israelis and the Palestinians, and the Israelis treated him well, and the Palestinians treated him horribly. And so when his eyes have been opened to that, and he's been able to meet with other Christians, with other Jews, there's something that happens when you can have that personal conversation, when it's not just this abstract Israel versus Palestine, you know, all that stuff. And so my heart for it is, I think the older generation, they're theologically more astute, but sometimes they're relationally deficient,
which
I think is a big point we make in the book, whereas the younger generation is theologically less astute, but I would say relationally more more effective. And so I think if we can combine those two, we've got a winning match.
Yeah, great point. I love the way you've both put it. I love your hearts in this. That's why I endorsed the book, wrote the foreword to it. God, Israel, and You, Michael and Joshua, thank you for joining us today. Let's get this right. It's essential that we do. Hey, this is Michael Brown. I want to invite you to join me for our second ever trip to Israel, February 25th through March 6th, 2017. This is a great opportunity. I get to interact with you, our radio listening audience, and our ministry partners as we experience the land of Israel together, and it will be a life changer. We've got a great price on the trip, and if you're one of our monthly supporters or torchbearers, you're eligible to receive a special discount for this once-in-a-lifetime experience. Space is limited, and we're accepting applications on a first-come, first-served basis. For more information on the trip to secure your spot, go to AskDrBrown.org, click on the Israel banner, or call our office at 704-782-3760.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
The voice of Barry Weber on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. By the way, we play clips. Sometimes they're from Jewish believing friends, Jesus followers, Messianic Jews. Sometimes they are from Israelis that are not believers in Yeshua. We play them to remind you it's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday and to stir our hearts with our connection to the Jewish people. 866-34-TRUTH. Any Jewish-related question you have of any kind, my joy to do my best to help you today. Join us in Israel next year. Go to the website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. And I believe if you're able to do it, it really will be the trip of a lifetime, February 25th to March 6th. But now's the time. I know it's May, but now before you know it, it's going to be December. Before you know it, the trip's going to be here. So get your deposit in, join us. I've never seen anyone that's gone to Israel that did not say, because some of my friends lead tours constantly, did not say it was worth every dime and they want to go back. All right, before we go to the phones, some Jewish news for you. Reebok, this is reported by Times of Israel via JTA. Reebok denies Israel 68 sneaker amid anti-Israel anger. Reebok announced and then quickly rescinded plans to sell a special edition sneaker commemorating Israel's 68th birthday. God forbid Reebok celebrates Israel's 68th birthday. On Tuesday, one day after Reebok Israel said it would market a blue and white sneaker engraved with Israel 68 as a collector's item for sale in Israel internationally, the sportswear firm said the announcement had been made in error, according to the Jerusalem Post. Quote, Reebok would like to distance itself from the shoe. The shoe was a one-off initiative from one of our partners. We do not support this initiative. The company added, Reebok believes in the unifying power of sport. Our main focus and priority is to inspire people everywhere to be their absolute best, physically, mentally, and socially, unless you're Jews in Israel. Yeah. And according to the Electronic Intifada, which had called for a boycott of Reebok products, Reebok has offended Palestinians and particularly millions of Palestinian refugees who were ethnically cleansed by Zionist militias and later Israel during the 1948 Nakba, so the disaster, and are still being denied by Israel's apartheid their right to return home. This is according to the Gaza-based boycott, divestment, and sanctions activist Abdurrahman Abu Nahel telling Electronic Intifada. You've got every word of anti-Israel propaganda built in to that one statement there. Remarkable, but not surprising. This is both remarkable and surprising. This goes back to March, but I'm just seeing it now. Egyptian-German scholar Hamed Abdel Samad claims our hatred of Jews has poisoned us. You find this on Memory TV, memritv.org, which monitors what's being spoken in the Muslim Arab world, around the world, or Iran, in Farsi, different languages. They will somehow have tapes of what's being preached in the mosques, or they will have excerpts of what's being seen on the TV. And a lot of it is just shocking, chilling, children's programming, encouraging Jew hatred, and even murder of Jews. But here, there's a lecture posted on the internet March 21st by the Egyptian scholar Hamed Abdel Samad. And he said the Prophet Muhammad had lowered the Jews to, quote, a subhuman level, viewing them as animals. And he compared the treatment of the Jews in the years following Muhammad's death to that of the Nazis. And he said, this hatred is poisoning us. Wow. He says, today we will talk about Islamic fascism and the Jews. We've had a fixation about the Jews since the inception of Islam, and this fixation refuses to come to an end. The Jews have always been small in number, but they cause us some mental reaction, and we cannot get them out of our mind. He said another issue that is similar in fascism, Nazism, and Islam is the view that Jews are like animals. Hitler used to call them Ungeziefer in German, or vermin. In Nazi publications, they used to draw them as mice. Likewise, when Muhammad had had enough of them, he called them apes and pigs and the worst beasts in the eyes of Allah. By the worst beasts in the eyes of Allah, he meant the Jews. He lowered them to a subhuman level, viewing them as animals. What do you do with animals? You slaughter it, you sell it, you ride it. This is the logic with which Islam treats not only Jews, but non-Muslims in general. What does he say at the end? He said, is the Mossad paying me to say these things? Am I saying this because it serves Israel, the Jews, or someone else? No, I'm saying this because this hatred is poisoning us. We have wasted vast efforts on this hatred. We have invested a lot in this hatred. This hatred prevents us from dealing with our problems in a serious way. You always need an enemy on which to pin all your catastrophes. Anything that happens to you is a conspiracy. Whenever something does not work your way, the Jews are the cause. It's much easier this way. Wow. I wonder what has happened to Hamed Abdel Samad for posting that. Incredible. Incredible. Sorry to bring it to your attention just now, but I just became aware of it. Wow, wow, wow. 866-34-TRUTH. You have a Jewish related question of any kind. This last week celebrated Yom HaAtzmaut, the Day of Independence in Israel, along with Holocaust Remembrance Day, the two celebrations and memorials in very, very close proximity one to another. 866-34-TRUTH. We go to East Bend, North Carolina. Michael, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you for the time, Brother Michael.
Hello.
Quick question. That's a quick question.
Yes, please.
Do we worship the same God that the Jewish do, including the ones that do not believe Jesus being the only way?
There's a yes and no answer to that. The yes is obvious. We're both talking about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We're both talking about the God of the Old Testament, the giver of the Ten Commandments, the King of the universe, the Creator of the universe. We're talking about that same God without question, right? And
yes.
And we also believe in him having the same moral characteristics that we see spoken of in Scripture. So when a traditional Jew prays, that's the God they're praying to, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of our fathers. They're quoting verses from the Old Testament as they pray. They're quoting the Psalms as they pray. Well, the same with Christians, and I'll say we as a Christian and as a Jew, we're praying to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We're quoting from the Psalms. We're looking to the same scriptures. However, we believe a couple of essential things that are different. We believe that God is triune, that God is Father, Son, and Spirit, and a traditional Jew would find that concept for a Jew to be idolatrous and for a Gentile to be misleading, if not idolatrous. So they would deny God's triune nature. What I've argued, Michael, is that even in Judaism, God's unity is complex. God's unity is complex, and we can show his triunity through the Old Testament. But there would be a difference there. Traditional Jews do not worship God as a Trinity and would reject that concept. And traditional Jews do not believe that God in any way was incarnate in Jesus, that God in any way walked among us in the person of Jesus. So there would be differences there. But overall, my whole argument would be absolutely yes, we worship the same God. Traditional Jews do not understand him in his fullness, but it is the same God. That's how I would answer that.
Thank you for your answer. May God bless you and your radio ministry.
Thank you. And, yeah, it's a quick question. It's not as easily answered, though. Thank you. 866-34-TRUTH. A couple of other... I want to get to these news items. Yeah. Let's just do this. Alon Gilad talks about this on in Haaretz, the one of the leading historic Jewish, also left-wing publications in Israel, talks about how Israel got its flag and what it means. So I'm going to get to more calls and talk about this. Israel Independence Day, Israel 68 years old now. Amazing, isn't it? We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Israeli Jews singing next year in Jerusalem. This has been the prayer, the cry of Jews for centuries around the world. That's why it's so easy to recognize God's restoration of the Jewish people back to the land. We continue to pray for spiritual restoration and for the salvation of the surrounding nations. 866-34-TRUTH, number to call on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday and on this week celebrating Israel independence. Before I get back to the phones, Alon Gilad speaking about how Israel got its flag, what it means. So the Star of David, the Star of David has not always been a Jewish symbol, called the Seal of Solomon, used for to ward off evil spirits, used by different groups, including groups on the dark side, you could say, satanic groups. It's been used as a symbol many different groups and places, but several hundred years ago, according to this article, 1648, Holy Roman Emperor Ferdinand II gave the Jews of Prague permission to fly a Jewish flag over their synagogue, and it had a Star of David at its center. So that's how it became largely associated, at least, since 1648, and before then, not as widely. The light blue and white, apparently, according to this article, goes back to the late 19th century when Ludwig August von Frankl, a Jewish writer from Bohemia, wrote an essay on the subject in 1864. In his paper, The Colors of the Land of Judah, he suggested that the colors of the Jewish people should be the light blue and white of the tallit, the Jewish prayer shawl, and then the Zionist flag. Both the Star of David and blue and white had become acknowledged as symbols of Judaism. All that remained was for them to be joined together in a flag. Very interesting. Very interesting. We go to Des Moines, Iowa. Kelly, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, brother. I have a perfect question for Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, as I just learned that I will be going with you to Israel next year.
Awesome. Very exciting, man. Very exciting.
It's going to be fantastic. And as an adjunct to that, I was wondering if you had any suggestions on how best to learn Hebrew, whether in a in-person class or perhaps software like Rosetta Stone or something like that?
Yeah, if you want, well, obviously in-person class is terrific. If you're able to get in a setting like that, that's always great. But often that's very difficult and that's not doable. So what I would suggest is that Rosetta Stone is a great way to learn modern Hebrew for sure. No question about that. It's, you know, it's great professional software and it's very helpful in that regard. In-person classes are great. You also have, this is more expensive, but you can get in-person tutors online. But I think Rosetta Stone, because you can pronounce things back, it'll monitor that. That can work really well for modern Hebrew. And you work at it for a while, you'll be able to, you know, converse a little when you're over there or have the fun of trying out your Hebrew. The other thing is there's a website, Hebrew and then the number 4 Christians, Hebrew for Christians. And let's just see here. Is it hebrewforchristians.org or .com. Hebrew for Christians, so it's the Hebrew number four, Christians, hebrewforchristians.com. That's a great place to learn. You're not going to become fluent in conversation or anything like that. Rosetta Stone's better for that. But Hebrew, the number four, hebrewforchristians.com, you'll find really helpful. And Kelly, can't wait to see you in Israel next year.
Excellent. Hope to meet you soon.
Yes, God bless you. Thank you. 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Dallas, Texas. George, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, can you hear me?
Loud and clear, sir.
Okay, you are one of my heroes, one of my very few heroes.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
My question is this. Regarding Melchizedek, is there a consensus amongst Jewish scholars as to who this person might be? And do you agree with that consensus, or who do you say Melchizedek was?
Yes, okay. Among traditional Jews, so very, very traditional Jews, they follow the Talmudic narrative, the narrative in rabbinic literature, that say that Melchizedek, or as we'd say in Hebrew, Melchizedek, was actually Shem, one of the sons of Noah. Now, there is zero support for this, zero support. And he'd have to have lived, you know, a very, very long period of time. So that is only believed by very traditional Jews. Otherwise, all we know about him is what's written in Genesis, the 14th chapter, that he was the priestly king of Shalem, which many associate with Jerusalem. So that's all we know. Now, when we get into the New Testament, George, now there's the question, as he's spoken of in Hebrews, the 7th chapter, as a prototype of the Messiah, having no beginning, having no end, but being a priest forever in that regard. And then Psalm 110, David/the Messiah is told you're a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So the question is, was Melchizedek Jesus in the flesh before? In other words, was he not a mortal man? Was he Jesus in the flesh, appearing briefly in the past and now appearing for a longer period of time, as Jesus walked the earth 2,000 years ago? Or is Melchizedek just symbolic of Jesus? In other words, the Bible doesn't give us his genealogy. It doesn't tell us anything about him, who his father was, who his sons were. He just appears and disappears. So in that sense, goes on forever. Scholars are divided over this, George. My own leaning is that he represents the Son of God, but was not actually the Son of God in the flesh, that he is representative of him as if having no beginning or no end, rather than being the Son of God in the flesh. But there's no way to prove it either way. And he's one of the...
What do you think about possibly a manifestation of the Holy Spirit?
It would be less likely to me, because the Holy Spirit's job is normally invisible. In other words, he works among us, but he's unseen. Yeah, you can see the glory of the Lord and things like that. He can manifest God. But when it comes to in any type of representation of God that can be seen in with character, so people seeing the God of Israel, Exodus 24, or Yahweh appearing to Abraham, Genesis 18, that seems to be the role of the Son, that the Father sits enthroned in heaven and is the origin and Father of all things, and his presence fills the universe. The Son makes him known. When we see the Son, we see the Father. The Son is the radiance of the Father's glory. And then the Holy Spirit working behind the scenes, bringing about God's will, the one that can be grieved by our behavior and actions, because he's the one with whom we interact. So I would see it as more the role of the Son. Hence, it could have been an appearance by the Son of God in the Old Testament. It's possible, but to me, less likely, although the debate will continue. Hey, thank you for the call and the kind words. Hey, out of time. Tomorrow's, you've got questions, we've got answers. Glad to take more calls at that time. And be sure, go to the website, askdrbrown.org. Click on the Israel banner. Join us in the land next year. My bottom line today, if your heart's right with God, I believe ultimately you'll have a bird to pray for Israel.